As many as 50 million people across America don't know how they'll put food on the table right now. That includes thousands in our area, including many military families. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at the acute hunger and food insecurity crisis happening now in this pandemic and how you can help this holiday season. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we've got the story of one local author's reinvention in this extraordinary year. Plus some of the big band sounds from Crescendo Amelia. That's later. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. Our area added more than 1,200 new cases of coronavirus Wednesday, the highest single-day spike the Florida Department of Health has recorded since the start of this thing. 825 new cases in Duval County alone yesterday. So we are heading into a dangerous period. The vaccine has arrived, but that is not a signal to let your guard down. Do the opposite. Please keep wearing your masks. Keep social distancing. Keep avoiding large indoor gatherings for a few months longer, everyone. Well, we are 9 months into this, and lines outside food pantries are still a common sight across America. Families waiting in row after row of cars as far as the eye can see. Last year, more than 35 million people experienced food insecurity in this country. But because of the pandemic, the number could grow as high as 50 million this year. That according to the hunger relief organization Feeding America. That includes many active duty military families too, by the way. And with multiple federal aid programs set to run out soon, many pantries are worried about their stocks of food. This crisis is just as acute in our area as it is everywhere else. So right now, we're going to begin the hour with a closer look as we welcome Sarah Dobson, Director of Development with Feeding Northeast Florida. She's on the line. Hi, Sarah. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Are you out of work? Have you needed assistance from a food bank? What are your questions and comments about the food insecurity and hunger crisis America is going through right now? Call us up, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is also open. And Sarah, you know, since this whole thing started, the spike of people seeking help from food banks like yours is up some 60%, your parent organization, Feeding America, reports, even including some of your volunteers and donors. So are you seeing that here in Jacksonville as other food banks are, people coming to you for help that you never would have thought might need it?
Absolutely, Melissa. Unfortunately, that is correct. We're probably seeing about double the amount of people coming to our food distributions than we have in the past. And at times it's been much higher than that. But right now we're about double. And the unfortunate reality is we just see no end in sight. We don't see that number decreasing anytime soon. And you mentioned Feeding America. They tell us that nationwide, 4 out of every 10 people seeking the help of food banks and food pantries are coming there for the first time in their lives. So that's a staggering statistic. We see no end in sight for the next year, 18 months.
That's right. I mean, the vaccine is here, but that doesn't magically put people back to work in this crisis. Now, this week, Publix announced it's donating over 1 million pounds of food to food banks statewide, including yours, Feeding Northeast Florida. That's going to help. So I would think that helps somewhat. But what is the situation at your food bank, and how concerned are you about the end of federal aid programs that are helping get food to people that need it the most right now?
Well, exactly. That's a huge concern. Of course, we, as many food banks nationwide, have been the beneficiary of what a federal USDA program called Farmers to Families Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. That's been instrumental in helping us meet the need, or I should say try to meet the need over these past 9 months. That's ending at the end of December. So yes, we absolutely are looking for new ways, more ways to get food to those in need. Donors like you mentioned, Publix. That's an incredible help, of course. Individual donors as well. You know, just to put things in perspective, last year we distributed about 17 million pounds of food across our 8-county service area. This year, we are on track to distribute 31 million pounds of food. So that's nearly double. So, of course, we've done that through the generosity of friends. But, again, it hasn't solved the problem.
Doesn't solve the problem.
Need is still ever present.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the single most important thing the government could do right now to address this crisis?
So thanks for asking that. We're working with city, state officials, as well as Feeding Florida and Feeding America to urge Congress to boost SNAP benefits to help offset the record high grocery prices, and also to support more USDA food purchases. We think that's one way that that we can offset that loss.
And they're close to a new, more broad-based economic relief package after dithering about that for months. So let's hope they do that before the end of the year. Now, you know what, Sarah? The New York Times reported just yesterday another wrinkle to this crisis. Military families. Lower-income families in the military have a specific set of challenges. They tend to have more kids than average, and most kids are home from school right now, so they're not getting free or reduced lunch. Military families often receive a housing allowance that renders them ineligible for food assistance. That's a quirk in the law that Congress has repeatedly failed to fix. The most junior enlisted military personnel earn from $1,700 to $2,700 a month. According to a new report, up to 18% of military families and veterans have had someone in their house seek emergency food assistance in this crisis. Hunger experts say most Americans have no idea that people serving in the military need help to eat and feed their families. You know, we try not to editorialize at this radio station, but, you know, this is just so unacceptable. It's just so unacceptable that we have people serving their country in the military, including hundreds and hundreds of families in our area who can't feed their families in this crisis. And so can you talk a little bit about that part of the population?
Absolutely. And I will say that I was in a similar boat as probably many of your listeners, that before I started working with Feeding Northeast Florida, I didn't realize that. But it's absolutely true. As you mentioned, most of the junior enlisted folks, what they make cannot support a family. And you also have to think about if there's a second spouse in the household, because of deployment cycles and moving, usually the jobs that they are able to secure are many hourly jobs or part-time work, and those are the jobs that, of course, have been hit the hardest through this pandemic. But I will say, Feeding Northeast Florida, we work with a number of veterans organizations as well as organizations that serve active duty military. We just recently had fortunate to have a distribution up at the USO Mayport, and they have a terrific program there to help their active duty families. And that's just one example. We work with a number of organizations, but it is a significant problem. And as you said, it really is unacceptable that families serving the country and already making that sacrifice would have to worry about how to put food on the table or how to put food on the table and be able to purchase diapers. It's unacceptable.
We're speaking with Sarah Dobson of Feeding Northeast Florida about the hunger and food insecurity crisis in America and on the First Coast. In the ninth month of this pandemic, demand at food banks is off the charts. And so we want to hear from you out there, whatever your situation, 549-2937. Matt on the West Side. Hi, Matt. Good morning.
Hi. Hi. I'm wondering where some of this data is coming from about a military and young troops and how accurate it is. I spent over 20 years in the military with over 300 young troops under me. The only ones that had problems feeding themselves or their family were the ones that had financial problems and a lack of financial discipline to start with. What's not reported probably is that a lot of these young guys and gals, they come into the military and they don't know how to balance a checkbook to start with.
I'm sure that's part of it, Matt. You know, I was quoting the New York Times, and they sourced a report from the advocacy group Blue Star Families. And according to Blue Star Families, 7 to 18% of military families and vets are seeking emergency food assistance right now. It's a small piece of the overall pie of the, you know, 40 to 50 million Americans dealing with food insecurity right now, Sarah. But in our community, I thought it was important to talk about this for a few moments since we have a lot of military listening out there. We have a heavy military presence. And, you know, as Matt pointed out, young people do have trouble sometimes budgeting and such. But there are special challenges, as you said, that they face. Constant relocations. They can't transfer professional licenses from state to state. Military spouses are often first fired and the last rehired in a weak economy. As the New York Times reports, many families do struggle with managing their money. Junior people do struggle with financial literacy. They can be isolated with a thinner social network. There are a lot of things going on with this population, Sarah.
Right. And I think there are probably other solutions, you know, long-term solutions that maybe there's needs to be more education or training in financial management for younger military. But, you know, that, of course, is not my area of expertise. We just have to deal with the crisis that's upon us right now. And we know that it is significant in this population, of course, as well as
many others.
Overall,
mm-hmm. Yella. And 549-2937, as we talk about the hunger and food insecurity crisis in this pandemic. In a few minutes, we'll have some information about how you can get help or give it. Ellis is on the West Side. Ellis, hello. Good morning.
Good morning. The question I have is, obviously, if I'm giving you $10, the most effective way to do it is credit card online. But at what amount of money does it become where you would end up with more money if I did it by check or whatever? I've never have been able to get an answer from any organization on that.
Okay. The best way, yeah. Thank you, Ellis. Now, Sarah, the model you have at Feeding America and Feeding Northeast Florida means that if people do give you $10 like Ellis wants to, that money can go a long way. Can you talk a little bit about the best way to donate and how the money is used?
Sure. Now, either way, check or credit card, we receive almost the full amount. I will say, in credit cards, sometimes there are those fees associated, but through our website, the donor can actually choose to cover the fees to process that credit card or leave it to the organization. But if the donor wishes to, they can cover those fees. So I'm not sure if that's exactly what Ellis was getting to, but just with our buying power, we can, for every dollar, that helps enable us to provide 6 meals to those in need. And different food banks throughout the country have a very similar structure. As you mentioned, Feeding America overall does as well. So that's incredibly powerful. And right now, we actually have a holiday match that was made by a generous donor, so that for every dollar you give, you can help provide 12 meals. And again, even though we know this pandemic and the crisis amongst the food insecure will last well into 2021 and will continue to need help. Right now, the power of your dollar is really maximized with the donation to Feeding Northeast Florida.
And Feeding Northeast Florida services a huge swath of Northeast Florida. It's 7 or 8 counties, isn't it, Sarah? And dozens of food pantries.
Yes, 8 counties.
8 counties.
And actually, 8 counties. And actually, you know, pre-pandemic, we worked with 200 charitable, some faith-based, all nonprofit organizations to help distribute the food through 8 counties. Well, since the pandemic has begun, our list is now up to 300 organizations.
Wow.
So we've grown significantly, again, just trying to meet that need exactly where it is. So, you know, we've been able to do so through some generous investments of donors, and really every dollar helps make that possible. You know, another tank of gas that we can put into our trucks to get the food to where it needs to be. Another refrigerated cooler that can help that safe transfer of produce and meats and nutritious foods. We're trying to meet the need exactly where it is and have made those investments throughout this pandemic just to get where we need to be.
Email from a listener in Camden County. Please let everybody know about help up in our area. The Camden Hunger Hotline is manned every day, and that number is 912-409-6920. Thanks for that. That's Tom up in St. Mary's emailing the show. Sarah, people sometimes want to drop food off at your warehouse. It's better, though, to just give money, isn't it? Isn't that the way that you've scaled this? That's a more effective way to help, is my understanding.
It actually is. I mentioned about our purchasing power, just being a large organization, part of a national organization, Feeding America. As I mentioned, that $1 enables us to provide 6 meals. So that $1 can do a lot more than, say, spending it on peanut butter and paying retail at your local grocery store. Of course, we appreciate all the donations of canned foods and food drives. It's just during the pandemic, a lot of those activities have been curtailed. You know, offices aren't working together and can't do a drive in the break room. It's been harder for neighbors to gather and do that. Really people have turned to donating monetarily, and it really does enable us to do more for each dollar.
1 in 6 Americans could go hungry this holiday season as the pandemic persists. As we talk about this with Sarah Dobson of Feeding Northeast Florida, Brian tweets the show, "How far into the year did you see the rising demand? Was it evident by March?" he asks. Have you been dealing with this pretty much all year, Sarah?
Yes, I mean, definitely mid-March, as soon as the lockdown occurred. Of course, then there was a tremendous amount of panic buying, as I'm sure you remember. A lot of grocery store shelves were empty, and we're the beneficiaries of many millions of pounds of donated food from grocery stores. So if you can remember, you know, there wasn't food on the shelves for purchase, so therefore there was less for those wonderful retailers and manufacturers to donate to us as well. So the need has been high since people started losing their jobs, and also we have had significant periods of shortage as well.
Let me ask you about Chef Jose Andres. He's an acclaimed chef and the founder of the World Central Kitchen. He single-handedly goes around the world and feeds people, sets up mobile kitchens at the site of multiple natural disasters and people in tough situations. This guy is amazing. Most of the year, he's been begging the government to address this food crisis. And he is calling for President-elect Biden to appoint a food czar to join the National Security Council to talk about this as a matter of national defense, that food insecurity is a national security issue. He's hoping that Biden would appoint a secretary of food, it's immigration, it's health, it's national security, it's job creation. I don't know if that's going to happen, but what are your thoughts about this take on the food insecurity crisis?
Well, I think it's fantastic that someone of his stature is shining a light on food insecurity in that manner. I mean, if you think about it, lack of access to food is a critical part in, or a critical factor in poverty. And so if you can help someone gain the stability in their household by having enough to eat, then they can begin to take care of other parts of their lives. Parents missing meals in order to have enough for food for kids on the table, or children having enough food so that they can learn at school. I mean, it really is a foundational necessity. And in our country, we have plenty of food. We have enough food to feed everyone. So it is a crisis in the fact that we have not been able to get it from where it is to where it needs to go to address the problem.
So with all of that said, we are heading into the holidays in the next couple of weeks. Do you have any special pantries set up, or is it business as usual? And how can people support Feeding Northeast Florida?
Yes, I mean, we have more pantries than ever. You know, I talked about our growing agency list. We now have 300 partners that do incredible work serving the communities where they're located. We also, in addition, do a number of mobile pantries, which is when it might not be within the hours of a particular food pantry or within the brick and mortar, but in a food desert. Last year we did over 400 mobile pantries. This year we have scheduled out through the end of the year over 1,400, so that's a 3 times increase. So yes, we absolutely have more activities and distributions, ways to get food out. But again, like you said, donations are really key to making this happen. And I mentioned the match we have, the challenge match, so it really makes your money go further to help more people than it would typically. And we're grateful for programs like yours, Melissa, that are shining the light on the problem right now. And I just ask your listeners to also consider that while we think about charitable giving and we think about families in need at the holidays, this will be a significant problem into 2021 and probably for the next year to 18 months. Keep involved, and we are always seeking donations and volunteers to help us out.
So go to feedingnefl.org, Feeding Northeast Florida. Do what you can. And thank you, Sarah. She's Sarah Dobson, Director of Development at Feeding Northeast Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead later. The sounds of some big band music on Amelia Island this weekend. Outdoors, of course. We'll have a preview of that. But up next.
So whenever a customer buys a book, they go to the bartender, show them the book, and they get a free preset shot.
An interesting strategy as a local author reinvents himself in the pandemic. We'll be right back. Well, local author Frank Ortegas got laid off from his job at Tesla in this pandemic earlier this year. Like so many others, he was out of work. But Frank decided to take advantage of the extra time on his hands and work on building up his career as a novelist. After getting more than 100 rejection letters from major publishers, Frank hit upon a creative marketing idea to sell his books. He started giving people free shots of booze at local bars if they bought one of his fantasy novels. Now, that whole strategy is on pause in the pandemic, but Frank's writing career is still taking off. Here is his pandemic story. Hey, Frank. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for letting me do this interview.
Sure. So you're a local author. You are out with a couple of different books, but like many authors, you have struggled to get the attention of a major publisher, which is so difficult. So you came up with a really unique idea. It's called Buy a Book, Get a Free Shot. And we're not talking about vaccines. So yeah. Tell me about this. How does this work?
So the concept basically is I partner with a couple bars, and on certain nights I go to the bar, set up my really unique-looking display. I actually get a lot of compliments on it. And I have a sign there saying that if you buy a book, you get a free shot. So whenever a customer buys a book, they go to the bar. They go to the bartender, show them the book, and they get a free preset shot. It's not going to be a high-end $20 shot. It's like a well shot. But a lot of people love it. They think it's fun, and they think it's like a cool way to buy a book.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And up until the pandemic hit, you were doing this at places around town like the Volstead, the Grape and Grain Exchange, and other watering holes, right?
Yeah. Right before, that's where I started. And after the pandemic, when I got laid off, that's when I decided to, I really want to do this full time. I want to see if I actually can make this happen. So I expanded out. I expanded out to other art markets too, and it's been pretty good. I've been getting a lot of great reviews on the books, and a lot of people like the concept about buying a book at a bar.
Yeah, that's kind of different. So tell us about the books. These are contemporary fantasy and even contemporary horror. One is called At the End of All Things. Tell us about that one.
That one is about... It's a story about a man who hikes into the Grand Canyon, and he's about to do something horrible. But a woman stops him, and she starts telling him these stories to talk him out of what he's trying to do. And he's trying to figure out how these stories connected to him, and even if the woman's real or not, because he thinks like he's having a hallucination.
And then the second, and that's one. So the second one is The Malediction of Lewin Glass, which is a really interesting title.
Yeah, I got that word from a couple of years ago. I was studying for the LSAT, and I was doing like the word cards, the vocabulary cards, and I got that word, which means curse. It's like old English for curse. And I'm like, one day I'm going to use that word. And I used that for the title, and basically that story is about a man who was a former Catholic priest, and he's a lawyer, too, and he was tricked into selling his soul to the devil to save someone he loves. So he has a year to actually find a way to get his soul back, and he travels the world, meeting gods and monsters, and at the same time, trying to find get a soul back.
That's interesting, too. So you come up with these great stories. You work really hard on the books, particularly since, as you said, you got laid off from your job. You were working at Tesla. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
What did you do for Tesla?
I was in sales when I left.
Okay. But the pandemic, you know, obviously resulted in so many layoffs, and you were one of those people. So, but I guess the silver lining of this is it did give you time to work more on your writing. But as you found, like so many authors have found, you got a lot of rejection letters from publishers because they said you had to build your own audience up before they would even consider taking you on. And that's why I think so many authors self-publish, and they learned, as you've learned, that you have to really find an interesting marketing strategy for your work.
Yeah, well, after getting like 200 rejection letters, I might be overestimating, but it's around there. This came to a point where I had a realization. It's like, if I have to do all that work just to get published, I'm like, I'm doing the publisher's job for them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it makes no sense at that point to continue for looking for a publisher, because I might as well treat this like a business, where my product is my art. So if I have to build my own audience, if I have to build my own social media presence, my own marketing campaign, then I might as well just, you know, not do a half measure, but go all the way and just treat it, like I said, like a business. Like, I am building my own brand, but my brand is my art.
And how do you feel it's come out as we close up the end of 2020 and, you know, the end of the pandemic is hopefully in sight? How do you feel it's worked out for you? Because this has been a challenging year, but you have found a way to work through it in a positive manner and pursue your passion.
I'm not sure this is bad to say, but like, you know, I'm not discounting the bad things that happened to a lot of people. I'm not the suffering that happened. On personal note, like, I grew a lot this year. Like, there was a lot of things, a lot of challenges that happened, and I'm honestly, I'm grateful for being laid off. Like, I feel so much more fulfilled and happier, even though there's times I get scared, times where I'm thinking, like, I'm crazy for doing this, I'm crazy for, like going all out. Like, this is what I'm going to do, I'm not selling. There's times where I really do think, like, I get scared about that, but then also at the same time, I'm happy. Like, I'm doing something I love. I'm actually being successful at it. There is money coming in from it, so I'm really happy about that. It's like, I actually, for the first time in years, feel like I'm on a mission, like something that's good for me.
That's great.
I know I'm not going back to working for anyone else again. I'm going to see what I have to do to make this happen.
That's really so inspiring to hear. And I think that, as hard as it's been for all of us, out of this crisis will come transformation for many people. So how can people find you on social media, online, and how can they be part of the stories you're creating with your books?
Yeah, so I have Facebook, so it's just under my name, Frank Ortegas. The business name, my little business name is called Rick Ann Lewins. So they type in rickannlewins.com. That takes you to their website. And also I have Instagram, which is the handles at rickannlewins too. But the books itself, you could get them on Amazon. If you type in my name or the name title of books, you check out the synopsis and the reviews and order the books from there.
Excellent. Well, author Frank Ortegas, it's really great to speak with you, and I'm sure I'll see you at a bar somewhere next year selling books and offering free shots once people can do that again. So have a great holiday, and thanks for sharing your story with us.
And thank you for doing this interview.
Well, recent vandalism of some provocative new street art is now being investigated as a hate crime. Several artists came together to paint three new murals on Blanding Boulevard near San Juan Avenue. But then last week, vandals ruined the artwork. The three murals were inspired during the months of nationwide demonstrations sparked by the deaths of Black men and women across the country. Right now, we are welcoming the husband and wife team behind these murals, Candace Clark, creator and founder of Black Mural Map. Hi, Candace.
Hi.
And her husband, artist Christopher Clark, also on the line. Hi, Christopher.
Hey, how are you doing?
Okay, guys. So good to have you both on the show. Candace, let's start with you. These murals were created as a way to raise awareness about the Black Lives Matter movement. What did people see when they first went up?
When you first see the murals, there's three murals by Christopher Clark, of course, Tatiana Kitchen, and then Maya Lane. And so they were all three were trying to display the message of no justice, no peace. The owners of the building, they actually commissioned it because during the first riot, they had people who spray painted no justice, no peace, and they agreed with the message. So they didn't want to erase it, but they wanted to find a way to make it more beautiful. And so instead of just having the words no justice, no peace, they came up with pieces that portrayed that message without actually saying it. And so Tatiana has a figure of a guy with a peace sign and a fist with the city of Jacksonville behind him. Chris has a piece of a young Black boy. And then Maya Elaine, she had a piece that is representative of ambiguous people. They just, were trying their best to display something beautiful that portrayed that message, and it's just unfortunate what's happened.
Yeah. Christopher, you're the artist behind one of the murals. Pretty disappointing that you put all this work into this, and this happened.
Yeah, it's pretty, it's sad. It's just pretty crazy. I do a lot of murals. I have several around town, and it's part of the job to do them every now and then, but never have I encountered anything like this. Like, this is just, just to think that somebody took the time to mix together chemicals that would just, like, completely destroy the paint all the way down to the window. It's just kind of crazy.
It sure is. And Candace, police are investigating this vandalism as a hate crime. What are your thoughts about that?
I would like to hope that, it was just somebody, being crazy, but, or kids just playing around, but something of this nature, where you're mixing chemicals, that's not just like a regular kid playing around thing. And with the fact that the artists have been met with some negative attention while they're working, and then there was the intentional erasing of the word Black mural map, and then certain things, I feel like it may be appropriate. I don't want to say like it's an absolute, but it just seems that way.
Well, now let's talk about your next phase. Chris, there's a GoFundMe set up for the recreation of these murals through Black Mural Map, because you're not giving up. You want to repair the damage and continue your artwork. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we're going to do our best to repair that side of the building. There's another side of the building that we're also going to paint as well. So, yeah, it hasn't deterred us at all. It's only made the passion to get this artwork up even stronger than before.
So people need to search this on GoFundMe, Candace. And how's that campaign going?
It actually went very well. It exceeded our expectations, and therefore we'll be able to repair the current murals, and we'll be able to start on the other side of the building. And so we're really excited. You can find it just probably by just searching Black Mural Map. We have blackmuralmap.com. We have an Instagram. We're out there.
You're out there. Okay. And Christopher, your mural work is really part of a public art explosion we've seen in this city in recent years, which has been really cool to see. And so how do you see these expressions of public art changing the landscape of the city?
For me, I think it makes the city look a bit more cultural. It adds a lot of character to the city. Rather than just having like bland buildings, it adds something for people to see. Art is not always seen as accessible to certain groups of people. Everybody doesn't go to museums or feel comfortable going into a museum or an art gallery. So murals, in a way, is like a street art gallery or a public art gallery that anybody can go and enjoy the art and take pictures and see reflections of themselves in the work, in the communities in which they live.
And Candace, you work with other artists too, and they'll be continuing into the new year.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, Chris, Tatiana, and Maya did this side of the building. The intention is to actually have three more artists create the next three pieces on the building. And then from there, we've been getting a lot of inquiries about, you know, I have this building or I have this business. And so I'm hoping, you know, that it just continues to grow and that we're able to help more artists put their artwork out there, because that's part of the goal, is not only to have images of representation, but also to make sure that the artists have work to do and ways to show their work. And so I'm hoping it just continues to grow from here. I have no doubt that it will.
So I want to thank you both and keep the faith into the new year. Go to GoFundMe and search Black Mural Map, or you can find their website or their social media accounts as they work to highlight and elevate Black artists and muralists around the city. Thank you both so much for joining us. She is Candace Clark, creator and founder of Black Mural Map, and artist Christopher Clark, a husband and wife team, part of the local art and culture community. Thanks, guys, and have a great holiday.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, but in a moment. You know, we've been talking all year long about how important it is not to go to big gatherings. If they are socially distanced, masked, and outdoors, it's a little bit safer to do so. And all of those protocols will be observed this weekend up on Amelia Island when the sounds of classic jazz and big band music take an outdoor stage. We will speak with Crescendo Amelia Big Band in a few minutes. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Don't go away. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robert Scott. I've been a sustaining supporter of WJCT for over 10 years now. I listen to WJCT all the time, and I have since I was a young adult. One of my favorite shows is actually a local show, and that's First Coast Connect. One of the great values, I think, is listeners are invited to call in. By the end of the hour, I'm definitely more informed about an issue. It's also made me think about it a lot deeper than I probably would have. This is WJCT News 89.9.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and services tailored for active retirees. Information at vickerslanding.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ed Yong, a science writer for The Atlantic, who's been covering the pandemic since it started. His new article is about the science that led to developing COVID vaccines in record time and the flawed science that helped lead to misguided policies. Join us.
Today at 12, here on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Tanya Mosley. We check in with Academy Award-winning actor Forrest Whitaker, who reveals his musical chops in the new holiday movie, Jingle Jangle.
I think all my life and what might have been.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Yet I stand here alone.
Millions owe thousands of dollars in back rent. The consequences are already clear.
Tens of millions of people are in danger of being evicted.
With moratoriums due to end in weeks, we'll ask Senator Elizabeth Warren what steps both Democrats and Republicans can take now to help those who could soon be homeless. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, how about this? You can enjoy some big band music this weekend on Amelia Island. How the Big Band Stole Christmas hits the outdoor stage at Amelia Musical Playhouse Sunday, and Crescendo Amelia Big Band is going to be showing out. Now, this is a full theater production with an 18-piece big band, singers, dancers, and actors. Dennis Negrin with Crescendo Amelia is on the line to tell us all about it. Hey, Dennis.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
This sounds like a lot of fun, and don't we need that after the year we've been through? Tell us what's going to be happening. This is an amazing performance.
Yeah, well, we're really excited. This is our seventh year doing the production, and, you know, it almost didn't happen because of the pandemic, but, you know, it's just a real celebration of the resilience of the musicians and the community and our fans. We actually had to add room on the stage. The venue's been really great, so we can kind of fit and kind of space out. So we're going to go through all of the holiday favorites with a big band. We've got four singers. We've got some dancing. We have an aerial silk rig set up. We have a special performance by one of our artists. It'll all be outside. We'll have a food truck. There'll be drinks available, cookies, that kind of thing. We're really trying to bring the community out in a safe, responsible way so you can enjoy the sounds of the holidays, you know, with your family or friends, in a way that people feel comfortable with.
So tell us a little bit about the precautions you're taking to adhere to CDC guidelines and so that people can enjoy this but still be safe.
Of course. So safety is really important to us, the musicians, and as well as all the fans. So what we did is we have reserved squares available where a pod or a group or a family can get, you know, a space on the lawn for them to spread out. We're doing bring your own chairs. Where the musicians can, they'll be masked up. I play trumpet, so while I'm playing trumpet, I'll need to, you know, not have that mask. But everyone will kind of be spaced out. We'll have a sanitation station. We're asking guests to kind of self-screen.
The works,
Yeah, and we'll be limiting capacity as well.
Okay.
Normally our production every year has hundreds of people in a theater, but this time it's going to be much smaller outside. So
yeah,
we're feeling pretty confident about it.
And bundle up, it'll be chilly. Now, your mission is to create vibrant, engaging, and meaningful performances that bring to life the incredible legacy of big band and jazz music. How important is it to you to keep this genre alive with these live performances?
I think it's really important. I think now more than ever, people are craving that connection. They're craving that art. They're craving that music, that feeling. So for us to be able to do what we love and share it with others, I think, you know, for myself and our musicians, the few gigs we've been able to have this year have really, really been important to us and our fans and our communities. They kind of help us and keep us going.
People can get tickets still at crescendoamelia.com, correct? Still some tickets available?
Yeah, that's right. We have tickets available online on our website. Guests, we still have a few VIP squares left, and then we have some general admission seating. It's all bring your own chairs. You want to bring a blanket, you want to bring some snacks or something, feel free to come out. We'll also have a food truck there. There's only about 25 spots left on either the 4 p.m. or the 7 p.m. show. So we're expecting we'll probably have to turn off sales on Saturday to make sure we keep it limited.
All right. So go to crescendoamelia.com. Get your tickets now for this Sunday's show. Two performances Sunday, How the Big Band Stole Christmas. He's Dennis Negrin with Crescendo Amelia. And Dennis, we're going to play a little bit of your sound to close us out. Thanks and have a great show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Here is Santa Claus is Coming to Town from the Crescendo Amelia Big Band. Enjoy, everyone. And we'll be back tomorrow.
Telling you why Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, he's checking it twice. He's gonna find out who's naughty or nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping, and he knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake. You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout. I'm telling you why Santa Claus is coming.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.